All right. Welcome to the Lockdown Leadership Network series on the Recruiter Startup Podcast. This is part two of our newsletter where we have grabbed lots of amazing information out of all the stuff that our members have been talking about. That includes work from home performance management, technology and innovation, international marketplaces, building your company for a sale, IR35, how you can get prepared for it. You know, should you be changing your model from 180 to 360? What mental health in the lockdown, commission structures, podcasting in the media? It goes on and on and on and on. We've had to break it into two episodes. This is episode two. If you have any questions, hit me up. If you'd like to come and join our community, it's free. Love to have you in there. You just need to be somebody who is running or managing a large firm or owning a recruitment firm. So, hit me up here or on LinkedIn, and I hope you have an awesome week. We're almost at the Christmas break. God knows I can use it this year. Arm me with harmony. This brings me on to a really interesting piece. So when we're pushed to work from home, it tests the boundaries of bricks and mortar.
Yeah.
And I had Liam Thomas on the podcast, and we were talking about how this has changed the strategy overall. And in terms of moving into international marketplaces, they're doing it from Hampshire, but they were thinking, you know what, I might have a big office in Manhattan, I might have a big office in downtown San Fran, Dubai, et cetera, et cetera. And he changed that to, I might just put one salesperson per region that can go and do meetings, do that rainmaking work that you mentioned before. So that's a big shift. And I said, is that an ego thing? Is it a practicality? And he said it was a mixture of both. He said, I think like we all want to be Johnny Big Balls with our office here and there and all the rest. But in real terms, no. If you've got the delivery, like factory for a better word, in the one place and everything runs amazingly and you've got like well-trained rainmakers in each location, then what's the need to put everybody in offices? And that comes down again to trust and that we don't need to have them in an office that we can see them doing work. So it's a change that I thought is fascinating. You seeing much of that when you're talking to people about their strategic structures at the moment?
Yeah, you're seeing that. And I think people realize as well, if they are going to have hubs, that you know they need to get the critical mass. So it's better to have 50 people in one place than 10 people in five places, because then you can build up that scale. You can build up that culture. And actually, I think, you know, when I was looking at my consulting business last year, one of my concerns was that, you know, when I'm here in Cape Town, you know, are people going to be interested in working with me if they can't sort of see into and actually, you know, the customers that I brought on this year, you know, and even going to business with yourself and Charlotte, you know, never met you. It had all been virtual, it had all been video. So I think this year has just proved that that's all possible, and you don't need a huge infrastructure. You just need to be able to deliver what you were going to say.
In the bounty, There was a lot of chat and a bit in the bridge as well about selling a recruitment business. And we did a series of podcasts with brokers, with financial people, with movers and shakers, and those who've been there and done it and have sold their recruitment business and have had massive exits. Some stuff was interesting. I mean, the market for selling your recruitment business isn't great. I think you were saying that you heard that the overall market is betting against recruitment?
Yeah, it's a little bit. I think there was some stuff that Credit Suisse came out with that was similar to that. But you know, the businesses will be back. And although there's probably not the appetite right now, or you know, there are deals being done, but probably not at the multiples people would have hoped for. The fundamentals of most recruitment companies are pretty decent, especially if you've got a good contract book, you've got good recurring revenue. You know, the permanent part of the business is very cash generative. So, you know, they are decent businesses. The thing you have to be wary of is disruption. and where that disruption is going to come from. And that's why I think some of the bigger institutions are betting against recruitment, because they think that there's going to be disintermediation, and you know, it'll go the way of estate agents, or it'll go the way the insurances was the other one used. I don't think so. I think there's a number of different fundamentals in the market around recruitment that make that different. But yeah, good businesses will get sold. An interesting quote actually from a guy who used to work with at S3. He said, "No one ever sells a business. Someone always buys a business." And what he meant by that was that the reasons you want to sell your business are obvious. You want to take the money, get a bit of cash off today. But why would someone buy your business? What is it they're buying?
Yeah.
And actually, when I'm working with you and other advisories, if someone came in and said, "We want to buy your business," what would they find? What would they actually be buying? And actually being very clear on what you are, what you have, your assets, which are your data, your people, your processes, your structures, your customer base, just being really, really clear around that. And those fundamentals haven't changed because of the pandemic.
Yeah. The interesting piece for me was just learning about what that sales cycle looks like from the international brokerages and the PE houses to the regional brokerages to the people that they use for due diligence, to commit financial due diligence, to the people that they use for business operations due diligence, and getting all that stuff right at an early stage to make sure that you're all on the same part, the same direction, really, and that you're ready for that sale. The fact that perm only businesses sell if they're in a good niche was interesting. They're in a good location was another one. There seems to be a continued appetite from large conglomerates in Japan to hoover up the best rec tech and a combination of niche recruitment players. As I think the obvious thing is that the future of these agencies, it's going to be a mixture of rec tech plus an agency, because they want a slice of that technology to make sure that they're in place for the future. So I thought all that was fascinating, and getting the different takes on some of the experts that we had on from Australia, from Japan, and the UK. We talked a lot about personal branding. It's a bit of a wanky subject, Andy. It makes a lot of people cringe, and I've become a bit of a poster child for it, despite myself. It seems to be more and more important. My thing about it is, I think the business should take care of a lot of it, and the recruiter should be left to recruit as much as possible. If you're going to do a podcast, which is a great idea, and if any of the other Rector X want to copy the 15 other people who've copied my podcast, like, more power to you, on you go. But you need to have a marketing person there to do the editing, to be able to do a large part of it, or to outsource it to somebody. Otherwise, you're just going to mess around on social media all the time and make no money, and you'll be on your arse in no time. Brand is super important. It's what people say about you when you're not in the room. There's a whole structure of getting it right. But like anything, and a part of the mastermind that this came up, it all comes back to the niche. So who are the 2,000 people that you're trying to speak to in your niche? Who are the 100 clients? What do they say about you? How can you influence? That's your brand. Are you in front of them? Are you in front of them sharing stuff that's going to help them? Sharing them? Are you part of whatever it is? And then ultimately, for me, the end goal is what we're creating with LLN. It's being able to create a community and a network out of brands. So
yeah, 100%. We saw that even more, and being famous. What is it you can be famous for? And there's some people who became very famous during the last lockdown, and become very famous this year. And I think what you've done really well with the podcast is you've been consistent. I think people try, have a go, do it for a few times, then don't, and then expect they're going to get results straight away. But actually, I think building the podcast brand is what you're famous for. You're certainly not famous for doing any work. So.
Yeah, I'm definitely not famous for Rectorec.
No one ever grows up wanting to be a Rectorec.
This is true. This is true. One day. Do you know what? I'll tell you what Rectorec I love. I love dealing with just top performers. And I love dealing with top performers that want to move abroad. They're the two things. You know, it's hard to get a call with me if you're not. that's the truth. I'm not money hungry enough. But yeah, it's been good to us, Rectorec, and it's brought us to this point. So you have to take what I say with a pinch of salt on it. Commission structures was another one. Don't just copy the commission structure of the company you come from. All right. Why is that? If you're a startup, you're going to need to put something out there that's tasty to get somebody involved. We learned this straight away with Scale. We did it. We got the best talent in the market to come join us. Very happy because of that. Will I offer the same deal to the next person? Probably not, unless they're unbelievable. As you grow, you need to change your commission structure to whatever's appropriate. And that became really apparent. And there's a reason why the Page, Hayes, Half, Walters, all of them have rubbish commission structures. They just don't have to give it to you because they have the clients, they have the candidates, they're training you as a grad, and you're facilitating the work that they've done. As you go smaller and smaller and smaller, you have to bring more to them. Anything else to add on that?
No, I think it's one of those cyclical, I don't think anyone's ever happy with a commission scheme. I think leaders think they're paying too much and recruits think they aren't getting enough. So no one's ever happy. It's one of those things, isn't it?
Yeah, I always used to moan at Robert Walters, you know. When I look at it now, I was spoon-fed all those deals. I mean, they nearly just gift-wrapped it for me. They were paying me too much when I look at it now. But at the time, if you had listened to me, you would have believed that I was being hard done by. And that's what juniors are like when they start in an industry and they don't understand all the other stuff that goes on to running a company, to building a brand, to making all that happen for you.
Well, that's the thing is you phone up as Delta from Robert Walters. They're like, hiya. And you phone up as Delta from Delta Dirty. It's like, who?
That's not funny.
Before the podcast, when you started.
I've touched on this point already, but it's the 180 versus 360 versus 270. And I think, here's my thinking on this, right? Salespeople should sell, recruiters and account managers and relationship builders, they should be doing that. Somebody who's kind of good at both is a 270, but the business should be handling a lot of the stuff to get them into that position. I'd be led around if you're a small business, I'd be led around who you're dealing with, how involved you are. So if you're the principal person there and you're the salesperson and you're not great at the resourcing side, then get somebody to do that. If you're really good at the resourcing side, get somebody to do the sales side. If you're no good at the admin, get somebody to do that. So it just depends that model that you're going at. And I think what we've learned with the Richard Gibbard piece is you could almost take somebody with very little experience, as long as they're not phone shy, to do the sales side. And that's blown my mind because before the sales side was a bit more complex because you had to do all the strategy piece to it. Then you had to, like, so you're doing your ad chase and then you're matching your candidates and then you're working out, like, how can I go about this? You're doing your research on the person. You're trying to find an angle. You're doing all the research to find the data. You're doing that. And there's a ton of work. But if you get all of that there systemized and done for you and you're just there, like, lining them up and shooting them down, it's not as complex a job as it used to be. So anyway, that's my 10 cents on that.
Yeah.
You see a few more, like I'm just going from what I've built this year, but you must see a bit from some of the smaller firms that you're helping out at the moment.
Yeah, so typically with the smaller firms, what I always say is, look, the most important people are the owner founders, you know, and, you know, imagine, you know, they're player managers. So go and pick the position that, you know, you're best to play at, and then just surround yourself with people, which will probably be the thing you most like doing. If you like filling jobs, you're like, you know, that's the thing you'll be best at. If you like winning jobs, that's the thing you'll be best at. If you like the ops, that's what you'd be best at. But then basically just surround yourself with people who complement you. But the most important person is you, and then you build around, which is, you know, exactly what you were saying. How you build it, 360, 180 will be, 270 will be around your customer. The benefits of the 180 system are that you get people who are very specialist at what they're doing. The downside is that you can have feast or famine. So, you know, you need to have that nice equilibrium of jobs and jobs to work, basically. And if you've not got that, you've either got, you know, not enough jobs on to work, or, you know, and you've got resources then sat there doing nothing, or you've got biz devs who, you know, haven't got, you know, who can go out and win jobs and then can't get them filled. So 360s give you that nicer sort of blend, I think.
Yeah, they do. But then
before you get to scale, I think yeah. You know, there's a point where you've got enough flow of each where you can start to, that can become a bit more predictable. So look, it's horses for courses.
It is. I think the 360 job standalone is pretty complex these days.
It's really complex.
And if you can break it down and you're in a position to do that, break it down. Like I absolutely. And so, but if you're going to do the 180, the communication is key. So we would have a daily meeting where we go through jobs, we go through candidates, and we go through any of the problems that we have and interviews, all of that good stuff. Try and wrap it up in about 15 minutes, but make sure that the guys are all on the same page and talk all on the same page with regards to vacancies, action points, what to do, all the rest. And I think that anytime you don't do that and you have your two teams two separate, the communication isn't good enough. So if you can get them to do the meetings together, make that happen as well. IR35. So I didn't have a clue about this, but did a good podcast with Dell from JSA and walked me through some of the issues on that. You'll be able to talk much more fluently about this than me. The preparation seems to be key here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I ran the S3 project in 2017 into the public sector. And, yeah, again, it was preparation, everything. We moved, I think it's about 600 contractors, and we actually managed to grow our book because we were very much saw it as, this is happening. Okay, we can choose to deal with it in March when it happens, or we can deal with it 6 months out and start effectively talking to customers about it, getting them prepared, getting them to, you know, make, you know, sort their workers into groups. Looking at getting people assessed early, so it was done. And it's exactly the same with the private sector. I mean, I know that you know, JSA, for example, built themselves a tool to, you know, for example, you know, to give to agencies and supply agencies that can help them do that. Kingsbridge as well, you know, who we work with quite closely. You know, similar things. So there are the tools out there for agencies to be doing. My advice to any contract leaders out there right now is, you know, be prepared early. If you're looking at this in March, you're too late. Your competitors would have already both got the airtime because hirers are going to be interested in this. Hirers are going to be scared of it because there's potentially liabilities coming down the line for them. It's a real opportunity to put the consultant into recruitment consultant. You can actually help your customers with something they don't really know and don't understand. The other thing as well is that if you can work with customers to ensure that working practices are reflective of non-employment conditions, then you can start to, you know, effectively differentiate your product as well, which is massive, which all recruiters like to do.
And this world isn't my world. Like, you're the contract guy here. My expertise is everything else, obviously. What if they want to set up an international office and they want to do contract. Say, seems to be a big push towards Europe at the moment. What's the general process of how somebody goes about that these days? Can you use those type of companies?
Yeah. I mean, the international market, I always felt there were two speeds to the recruitment business. There's the UK and everywhere else. The UK is if you can do it in the UK, you can do it anywhere. It's more congested. It's more mature in terms of, you're up against, some of the in-house teams, the MSPs, RPOs, have obviously driven a lot of the rate down, for example, and have taken a lot of the process and freedoms away. So actually in Europe and the States, the markets are bigger, the fees are bigger, the opportunity therefore is bigger. There are cultural differences that you've got to, there's obviously a reasonable barrier to entry in some of these things around, you have to get it right. You have to be compliant. You have to do things properly. But yeah, my advice to people would be, do look at international business. It's a very attractive proposition.
And so if you're using a JSA or Kingsbridge for different elements of that, like do you just call them and say, hey, I want to do Europe, what do we do now?
Yeah, those guys are very UK focused, but there's some really good companies out there. For the States, you've got people like PGC and CXC, and again in Europe there's a number of different companies in individual territories that you can just go to. So typically I'd be really clear, it starts with who are your customers going to be. So what's our market, and again that's why niche is really important. If you're brilliant at data science in the UK, it's a lot easier to start data science business in Germany than if you were just very much a generalist in the UK to go and start generalist business in Germany. So your market, if you know your niche, if you know your vertical or horizontal that well, you should be able to translate that into another country. If you are more generalist, it will be more difficult because your analysis of the opportunity in those countries won't be as strong.
One of the other finds of the pandemic, somebody who's become a little bit LinkedIn famous, is Louise Archer. We got her in to help us out with our RectorAct business, and I'm going to get her to help the guys to sell retainers in the scale business. Seems to be a big push in the groups moving from these contingent agencies to selling retainers, don't you find?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it? You do all this work for a company, you find them product, you find them the perfect person, and they just decide they don't want it. I mean, you wouldn't get someone to come and build you a bathroom and then you come in at the end of the process and say, I don't want it. So I think people don't sell retainers for a number of reasons. I think first and foremost is they don't think they can. And I think Louise's course is brilliant at just sort of changing the mindset around, of course you can. And I think the other reason is sometimes people think they won't deliver or they want to give themselves the out. So if I can't find someone, then I haven't set that expectation as well. So for me, I think you're going to see a lot of shift towards that model as well, as a lot of people try and start the pandemic in March the lockdown in March. I think a lot of people wish they had a contract business or they had a long-term retain stroke subscription business. The interesting thing will be whether or not when people choose to fix that roof. And if when things start going well, January, February, March, like we've started to see the recovery, whether or not they think, okay, let's put those type of changes in now or just go back to being fully contingent
okay.
Businesses.
All right. Well, that's us today. Thank you very much, Andy.